Coming up on this week's show, a legendary name from the past is returning.
Turn your Game Boy into a portable radio.
And we continue our Amstrad celebrations with Roland Perry.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen their latest volume everybody's talking about at the moment? N64, a visual compendium containing over 150 titles that defined the Nintendo 64. From Super Mario 64, GoldenEye 007, Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, Banjo-Kazooie, and lots more as well. You can check it out on the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely friends at PCBWay. Now, of course, you know all about PCBWay. They offer fully featured custom PCB prototyping, low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and if you're in the market for services like 3D printing and injection molding, they've got you covered. And of course, you know that PCBWay, one of the biggest supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 426, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show. Of course, the podcast every single Friday celebrates all things about retro gaming and technology and brings you veterans of the industry onto the podcast to hear their story in the second half of the show. And I can't believe that this is our final podcast of April. Looking out my window now, recording this at nearly 8 p.m. It's still daylight outside, which I don't know about you, that definitely puts me in a better mood than when it's dark at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, I get up early for work, so I'm walking out about, you know, 6:30 in the morning, and it's sunny now, so I don't feel as much as an alien, you know, getting up in the dark and kind of going in like that. So yeah, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah,
still,
and of course,
freezing though.
Yeah, I mean, it just needs to be, you know, anything above like 2 degrees would be quite nice, I think. I mean, a bit of warm weather would be welcome. But of course, that does mean that we are looking forward to another summer of events, because it's a bit of a tradition, isn't it, that every year we kind of get ourselves out and about to as many retro gaming events that we can, often hosting panels as well. And of course, the big one in the last couple of years has been at your event, Ravi, which at the time this podcast comes out, only 2 months to go now, until your huge Amiga event that is going to be coming back in Nottingham at the end of June.
Yeah, 2 months to go, which is amazing. So, you know, if you want to get tickets, go to AmigaShow.com. So this is Kickstart 02, and it's the second of our events, and it's a UK Amiga Expo. So it's pretty much a huge kind of trade show with a community room, and we've got a bit mad this year. We've got a whole extra floor as well. Do you remember seeing the talks last time, Dan?
Yeah, last year you had it kind of all on one floor, didn't you? You had the trading area, then there was a little stage at the back with the talks on, wasn't there, last year?
Yeah, and the stage was like not the most amazing sound and stuff, but this time we've, like, you know, got a dedicated talks room and also like a full stage crew with a sound system. And, you know, some people love to come to these shows just to chat with mates, and some love to come and play. Some people love, like, bargains. Some people love to come and rave and dance as well, which is going to be happening on the Saturday night. We're having a really big after party. But I just also want to put a quick message out that, you know, we're about 50 tickets from selling off on Saturday.
Wow.
So, yeah, the response has been absolutely amazing. And, yeah, get them while you can.
What are the dates again?
The dates is 29th and the 30th of June in Nottingham, UK.
Yes, and get your tickets at AmigaShow.com. Of course, Joe and I will be there as well. Joe's going to be selling some games. We'll be raving it up on the Saturday night. That was such good fun last year. So, look forward to it.
I'm going to get Joe minute. Cleaning the toilets.
Oh, what?
He was a car park attendant,
yeah.
Isn't he? Yeah?
Yeah, that's it. On the car park, flipping the burgers.
Then a little bit later on in the summer, in August, we're going to be heading out to Norway again.
Oh, yes. We're going out to a Retro Messe, which is a... an event that we absolutely love to go to. I went over last year, and man, my mind was blown at how much it's expanded and how big it's got. This is in Sandefjord in Norway.
This is the 10th anniversary, isn't it? It's been going a decade.
10th anniversary of the event, yeah. And they're in a new venue. Last time they had, you know, music from Final Fantasy Live, which was just mind-blowing. the guys from Rare doing a Golden Eye. Oh man, it was just an absolutely amazing event. And, you know, we had some great talks, and every year we always record our talks as well and put them out on the podcast. So if you can't make it over to Norway, you'll be able to hear them. And we're going to do that again this year.
Yeah, so it's definitely one of my favourite events that we attend every year now. Like I said, I missed it last year because I had a family event on, but I'm looking forward to getting back out to Norway. This will be my third time out there, so it is going to be happening in August on the 17th and 18th, Retro Mesa 2024, the 10th anniversary. You can get your tickets for that at retromesa.no. And like you said, it happens in Sandefjord in Norway. So even if you don't live in Norway, it's definitely worth a flight out there.
Honestly, the flights are really quick, actually, from the UK. I was surprised. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, yeah, the Vikings invaded us, didn't they?
Yeah.
And they did it on a boat. Yeah.
Yeah, if they can do it, Ryanair can. Yeah. So, yeah, it's going to be a great event. Hopefully we'll see you there. And more announcements to come over the next few months as we fill up our summer calendar this year. Now, we're going to be continuing part two today of our Amstrad CPC 40th birthday celebrations, because as some of our patrons will have heard, because we did put the entire interview out as one big chunk to our patrons last week, and it is a good like hour and 25 minutes, I think, the full interview with that Roland Perry from Amstrad. Now, we thought it was probably a bit too long to put out as a single podcast last week, so we've split it in half. But this week, I mean, there was some really juicy stuff that we cover in the second half of this interview with Roland.
Yeah, you know, Roland was at the top there for a long time. And as we know, with Amstrad, they acquired Sinclair as well, which was a really different kind of change in time as well. And we kind of hear about Amstrad's attitude towards obtaining Sinclair and what they wanted to do with it, but also about lots of different machines as well that they had, because it wasn't just the CPC range as well, but they had PC clones, they had all sorts, they had some prototypes that we talk about, but also there's a machine that ran CPM as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, one of their higher-end machines in the CPC 6128. CPM that generally was, you know, it's quite a bizarre choice that they included that, because that was really used in the business market, particularly in America. And the fact that you think of the CPC machines, you know, they're really targeted at the home gaming market, really. So it was quite an interesting choice to go down that route with the later models of the machine.
I kind of loved how Roland says in this interview, you know, Amstrad kind of just released it, whatever it was. They just put it out there. They got it out there. And it's really interesting to hear about all the kind of different approaches and, you know, conclude our interview, which, you know, it's gone down really well. We've had some really nice comments from listeners that wouldn't usually check us out as well from the Amstrad world. So, I hope you enjoy this.
Yeah, so we're going to be hearing from Roland Perry as we continue 40 years of the Amstrad CPC. Definitely worth hanging around for that. He's going to be on the podcast in around half an hour from now. Now, if you're a regular listener, you know the way the show normally works is our first half of it, we do a little roundtable chat with us geeks about what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last 7 days. And has been another busy week in retro, including this headline that a legendary publisher that never really went away, but the brand did, that was, you know, behind some massive games back in the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s as well. They're going to be making a comeback, and I'm going to get Raffy to pronounce the name of the company.
Oh, no, we were discussing this before. Joe, what? I'm going to put the blame onto you. How would you say it then? I know some people say like a graham cracker, so Infogram.
You've proper stitched me up there, you guys, passing the ball around. So we are, of course, talking about the legendary game publishers, Infogrames.
Well, I actually did a bit of Googling, and I found this video on YouTube with the apparent official French pronunciation, because, you know, they are a French company. Have a listen.
Infogram.
So apparently that is how you officially say it. I know
a lot of people apparently, also it's reps and executives would use this strong A as well, so Infogrames,
right?
Or a soft A, so Infogrames.
Like Ravi was reading out like a Wikipedia thing or something, and it was like, oh, it's pronounced like the famous cracker, and he was like a graham cracker, and I was like, I thought they were called graham crackers. So I'm so confused now to how you actually say it. But not to take away from the headline of us three British idiots butchering it, Yeah, it's back, isn't it? But it's a weird one because it kind of did it ever really go away? Because it's part of Atari, isn't it?
Well, yeah, the story goes that basically Infogram, as I'm going to pronounce it for the rest of this story, they acquired the rights to Atari and then turned, basically Infogram rebranded themselves as Atari.
Right.
That's my understanding of it.
And like, you know, some of their early titles, Alone in the Dark was one of the first ones, wasn't it? I remember them from Unreal Tournament as well. Which is, you know, a title that I really loved. That was Epic Games, but then it was also released under them. And I think, you know, they're going to be getting a lot of franchises and old titles back and, you know, maybe re-exploring them. And I personally love to see a new Unreal Tournament game.
Yeah, so the reason they've brought it back, they've announced they've brought it back, as Atari is saying, is they're going to produce games, publish games under the Infogram banner as games which aren't, you know, usually an Atari IP. So essentially they're bringing, by the sounds of things, they're going to bring back, as Ravi's just said, other IPs which kind of were part of Infogrames, because of over the last kind of decade Atari have bought back like over 100 IPs. I'm sure there is a list out there, and obviously some of them will be part of Infogrames, which also had like Gremlin and Microprose under it,
and Ocean,
as well. Yeah. It's crazy when you look back, like how, you know, all these companies all just like started buying each other and stuff in the late 90s and early 2000s. But I guess like it's a little bit like the whole, you know, with I forget the, you know, in Hollywood,
Embracer Group, is that the one that you're on about? Or they're kind of doing the same where they're going around and collecting lots of rights and lots of old studios and that.
Yeah, yeah.
Bethesda as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of like in Hollywood, like, you know, how these big kind of like movie labels like Disney and stuff actually have all these other ones. Like, I think it's, I can't remember if it is Amblin, but, you know, if they do a film that isn't quite a Disney film, they put it under this different publisher, even though it's still Disney, for example. So it's kind of, I guess they're going to go down that route. Like, oh, this is an Atari game. It's a horror game, but Atari isn't usually a horror game, so it's an Infogrames game kind of thing, which we'll be interested to see. But I've just looked up like all the different games that were released under the Infogrames banner, and there is a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I don't know, looking at this, I'm like, well, which one will they bring back? Like, you know, there's some really famous ones, just to name a few, like Driver, the Unreal Tournament games, like you say, the Stuntman games. You know, just so many different games on there.
And Enter the Matrix was there.
Test Drive as well.
There you go. A lot of Dragon Ball Z games, which obviously still going huge. And it's just a huge, huge legacy. So it'd be interesting to see what they do with it over the next couple of years. Because obviously I imagine it'll be a while before these games start coming out. But it's nice to see. And it's very nostalgic.
What animal's in the logo?
It's an armadillo.
Ah, there you go.
I didn't even have to look.
I did.
Hogs of War as well.
Yeah, I was like, what is that thing? Is that a rat? Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, again, I mean, I've got very, you know, vivid memories of, you know, seeing their logo appear, you know, at the start of games and getting very excited, you know, particularly Alone in the Dark, which I did love back in the day. So it's going to be nice to see the Infogram logo ahead of games starting again. It does lead you on to an interesting question, though. Will they bring back any other of those brands we mentioned? I mean, it would be awesome to see, you know, the Gremlin logo back, or Ocean even, because, you know, they were massive brands back in the day.
I just want a Jurassic Park game with the Ocean logo at the
start. Oh, God, yeah. Can you imagine? So, yeah, if you want any more brands, you know, you've got plenty of good ones in your portfolio.
Do you think they might go down the route of retro releases, you know, re-releasing stuff boxed, or do you think they'd maybe go on a remake upgrade route, or a kind of continuation of series?
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
That is an interesting point. I think they might do compilations, because obviously Atari in the last couple of years have been hitting it out of the park with kind of releasing what they know their fans love, rather than going, I don't think a week goes by that we don't talk about Atari actually, like, you know, kind of fitting the needs of the consumer at the moment without doing all this random stuff. So I think they're going to go down retro kind of compilations, etc., or kind re-releases of on the Switch and stuff. Yeah,
doing a deal with like Anstream or Evercade, and pretty much instantly then, you know,
I could see
some cash going and some rights, and
I could see it going that way. Or, you know, here's an Infogrames, you know, compilation with 20 games on there or something like that.
Although they did sell the rights to Alone in the Dark to THQ. Yeah, yeah, back in 2018. So one of their biggest franchises they don't actually own anymore.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of an unfortunate time.
I think there's also so many, games that have been originally wrote by people that the original writers don't have any control over or rights anymore. And they're kind of passed around like trading cards a bit, aren't they, at the moment?
It's nice to see it back though anyway, a name that we recognise from the past. Welcome back, Infogrames, even though, like you said, Joe, never really went away, but it is going to be cool to see it.
Infogrames.
Yeah, however you say it. I think we've covered all different pronunciations there, so there's one correct one in there somewhere. Now, another big headline that I've been seeing everywhere this week was the Game Boy turned 35 years old at the weekend, which, a lot of people have been celebrating that, which it just seems like these anniversaries are happening all the time recently, doesn't it?
Does that make you feel really old? That the Game Boy is 35.
Yeah, so a legendary system. And, still a lot of love today. There's a very big homebrew scene on the Game Boy in terms of not only software, but new hardware as well. And this one, you spotted this, Joe. I think this is very cool. This is a new cartridge that turns your Game Boy into a fully functional portable FM radio.
Yeah, so this has been developed by a modder called Orange Glow, and it's called the Orange FM cartridge. There was, in the height of the Game Boy, there was radio peripherals.
Do you know what one was called? The Boombox Boy.
Oh, there you go.
And also the Game Boy radio, but they worked with the link cable.
Yes, they either worked with the link cable or with the headphone jack. What they pretty much did, which is different to the Orange FM, is the ones back in the 90s. They just used the Game Boy as a power source. They were a radio that used.
They were
the
like
Game
external
Boy.
Units.
Yes. Yeah. Whereas this actually turns the Game Boy into an FM radio, and it plays the radio through the speaker. And on this little video I've been watching of it, I am really surprised at how clear it's coming through. Like, I don't know what I was expecting. Like, I'm an absolute, I feel like an absolute idiot because I was like, well, how's that going to work? Is it going to come through like all 8-bit?
like the Game Boy's audio process is going to down.
And I had a proper moment when I was watching the video. I was like, oh yeah, of course. No, because it's just using this speaker. It's not using like the Game Boy's process.
Yeah, he's also using a Game Boy Pocket in the video, isn't he, as well?
Like, yeah.
I don't know how this would sound on an original DMG.
Yeah, that is a good point because it does work with a DMG and it works with the colour and then the pocket, which is using in the video, but it doesn't work on the Game Boy Advance or SP or any, kind of like clone consoles or anything like that later on. Interestingly, it doesn't work if you put a headphone jack in. So if you plug a headphone jack in, like to listen through the headphones, then it doesn't work.
All right.
So, yeah.
You have to listen through the Game Boy speaker then, do you?
Yeah, I believe so. Right. So, but I was pleasantly surprised at it, but what will you listen to these days on FM radio?
that's the thing. I mean, it does kind of feel like, they are trying to phase FM out. Mm. I was trying to think, I think our car radio does FM, but we normally have it on DAB.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to think of any other FM radios I own.
Well, I'm going to get a bit radio geeky here. So the reason it doesn't use a 3.5 is because that can be an external aerial antenna. So basically, you can plug in some like speaker wire with a 3.5 mil plug at the end and then, have a proper antenna attached to it so you can get better reception.
See, back in the day, do you remember when you had your Walkman, though, and you plug in your earphones into your Walkman, it would use the wire on the earphones as an aerial, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Any basic wire it would use. Like, I remember making a little FM little AM receiver actually when I was a kid, and I had a wire and I just like wrapped it all around the garden in a tree. And I was like, and it actually worked, and I was kind of receiving it. It's also got something which I think is absolutely amazing, which is RDS. So RDS is radio text.
Yeah.
And when you've got your like car radio, your old FM one, you'd get that scrolling text, and that was like a feature. I remember it came out in the 90s, and
tell you what song's playing or something, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Or if you were driving around London, some cool pirate radio would have like hotline number in something. But it's got a feature of RDS text on there as well, receiving that, which as a radio guy, I'm like, wow, that's absolutely, absolutely amazing.
Yeah, because, I mean, this does pass through some software onto the Game Boy as well. So there is software to drive the radio that runs on the Game Boy. So the way you do it, you actually tune and set your presets and see the radio text on the screen of the Game Boy. So it's not just, you know, you're not kind of blindly going around the dial. You actually do see it.
Yeah, and also it's got like preset modes and scan modes as well.
10 presets.
Yeah, so you can have your presets. And, you know, I love FM radio as well. And I think, I don't know if the UK is unique in this, but it's one of the places where DAB hasn't really kicked off as much as everybody thought it would. And, you know, FM's still massively used. I think at one point they were like, yeah, we're going to turn FM off, or we're going to have a phase out, you know, phase.
I think 2015 was the aim, but obviously that's well past now.
Yeah, and people are still like listening to FM a lot.
Yeah, so it looks very cool if you want to get hold of one of those. No word on pricing at the moment, but there is a little form where you can express your interest. So if you want to get hold of one, and basically there's a few options on there, whether you want one fully assembled or you just want the instructions and the parts. So if you want to declare your interest in that, and I'm sure they'll get back to you with their pricing, I will link that in this week's show notes. Now, while we're talking about very cool additions to Nintendo consoles, I did like the look of this one. This is a prototype controller that, by the sounds of it, is going to be made into an actual product that you will be able to buy by a company called Far East Pinball. They've made a dock for the Nintendo Switch that looks like it could possibly be the coolest way to play retro racing games.
I thought this was the... Do you remember the Tommy toy?
Yes, Tommy, yeah.
Tommy, or however you say it. I thought it was that with, like, the orange display from, like, the 80s.
Because someone did that, didn't they, a couple of years ago? Made, like, a mini Outrun cabinet inside one of those.
Yeah, they did. They did about 5-6 years ago. But I just thought it was that with a Switch stuck in the screen. And I was like, what?
Just imagine taking it on a plane. It's like, you know...
getting through airport security with that.
Yeah. That would be brilliant. That would be brilliant. But... yeah, like you say, Dan, this is by Far East Pinball. They've done away with the Joy-Cons. It doesn't really explain how they've done this, but imagine, you know, as we're a podcast, visualize one of those, if you know what they are, you know, Tommy toy. It does look like a toy, doesn't it? And it's like the screen of your Switch is on the right-hand side and it's embedded into like a dashboard console.
Yeah, so you drop your Switch in the top, I imagine, so it's like a dock.
And then on the left side, you've got your steering wheel, which actually has all your buttons on there. And then on the right side, just in front of the screen, there is a fully functioning like gear stick, isn't there?
Yeah.
But obviously it's like an Americanized gear stick. So, you know, it's kind of got like, you know, drive, park and neutral on there. And in the demo, they are playing Outrun, funny enough, on there, you know, and kind of going through the menus, etc., and using the gear stick to actually accelerate and brake, which is quite interesting. It does look very cool, but as Ravi says, obviously the whole point of the Switch is, you know, it's portable and you can dock it, etc. Probably wouldn't want to take it on the plane. It's not massive, but it's not small, is it?
No, you're going to get some looks.
maybe mount it on your dashboard for your kids to go on as you're on a long motorway journey.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea, actually. Or hook it up to the car and use it to drive the actual car. Yeah, no word on, you know, when it's coming out or anything like that. But, or if it's just a prototype at the moment. But yeah, it does very interesting, to say the least, because the peripherals for the Switch have been nowhere near as big as what they were for, you know, the Wii. We weren't talking about Wii U.
Yeah, or the Wii U. Like, yeah, there was so many. Like, the Wii ones, I think I'm discovering new ones every time I go into a charity shop. It's insane.
Yeah, the Wii bowling ball. Stuff like that. But with the Switch, I do see them. You know, I see them in game shops and stuff like that, but I think, you know, the whole kind of like motion controls and stuff, it just doesn't seem to have taken off as much for the Switch. It just doesn't seem as big to me. So it's interesting to see, you know, this kind of like prototype being made.
You guys ever have a driving wheel back in the days?
My brother had them because he was really into simulation, like, you know, driving games. So he was really into like Gran Turismo and probably like hard driver for the Mega Drive. So he had a PlayStation. He had that one that would work on the PlayStation and the Sega Saturn. I don't know if you remember that one where it had like the double port. And I'd often walk in on him after school or whatever, and he'd be sat on the steering wheel with the volume turned off on the PlayStation, doing all the sound effects himself as well. He was that into. He'll kill me if he's listening to this. He was that into his like driving sim games. But that was it, really. And I've got a friend, my mate James, who for his PS4 had the full on like setup with like gear stick and pedals and everything that he used to play. I don't know what he used to play on it, actually. I think I want to say he used to play the F1 games on there for his PS4. And, you know, he absolutely loved that. But I think the novelty of it wore off after a couple of months.
So I've got a friend, my friend Griffo, he's got like a proper kind of, you know, he's built like a driving cabinet.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a seat and like
a proper
Ferrari steering wheel, I think he might have branded on there. That he used it all the time. I mean, the only ones I've had, I mean, I've got the Xbox 360, you know, the official Microsoft racing wheel that my missus brought home from a charity shop one day.
Nice.
Used it a couple of times. They take up a lot of room, though. That's the only thing when you've got steering wheel setups. You know, if you put them in the cupboard with the pedals and everything as well, they do take up quite a lot of space. The only other one I've got is the Logic 3 freewheel, which is that wireless thing that you hold in the air for the Amiga. I think you brought that back for me. I think Nostalgia Nerd gave that to me, Ravi.
Yeah, you brought it back. It's like, you know, when you're playing with your grandma and she's like moving the controller left or right or something. It's kind of like that, isn't it? You just do it in the air, like you're holding a plate, or like the Mario Kart controllers, actually.
Yeah, I did have a few goes on playing Nigel Mansell on the Amiga with it. It did work reasonably well. You know, it's pretty cool. But yeah, steering wheel setups were nothing I really owned properly back in the day. Probably, you know, again, because they were quite pricey and they took up a lot of space. But I think, you know, this little setup here, having a, you know, basically, like you said, it turns it into something that looks like one of those Tomy toy cars for the Switch, I think. Nice little way to play something like Outrun on there. At the moment, I mean, you've only got this prototype, which is mostly 3D printed by the looks of it. But if they do manage to get these out at an affordable price, I think it would be a nice bit of novelty to play racing games on your Switch. So we'll keep an eye on that one. Now, let's talk about something else that I think is very cool. This is a legendary title that has been ported to the Sega Dreamcast. Now, this is Doom 64, which was a very unique version of Doom.
You say it's been ported?
Well, it's in progress.
It's in progress. It's a proof of concept. So this comes from a developer, JN Martin 84, who's been doing some really fantastic demos and ports and stuff recently. We spoke about him the other week for porting Open Lara, you know, Tomb Raider to the N64 not too long ago. And he's now working on Doom 64, like you say.
So that gives me faith that he's going to finish it, because this guy's normally committed.
Yeah,
his good words.
Yeah, absolutely. Porting it to the Dreamcast. And at the moment, it is quite bare bones. It's very clearly Doom 64, and it's got a really good, you know, frame rate, and he's running around the levels, etc. But there's no enemies, no weapons, a few graphical glitches, the HUD's looking a little bit unfinished. But proof of concept is there. He's put it out, and there's as you guys know, because, you know, we've had so many Dreamcast developers on over the last couple of years who are still developing for the Dreamcast and homebrewing, etc., and Dreamcast Junkyard, you know, DreamPod and stuff like that. You know, there was a big community out there, so they're all reaching out to help on this, right. You know, all the different modders and stuff, which is really, really cool. So I definitely think this will be finished, and I don't think it will take too long, to be honest.
I think it's a good choice of game to port as well, because, you know, we've seen standard Doom being ported to like everything, and it's kind of become a bit of a meme, isn't it? Like, does it run Doom?
Yeah.
But I think having, Doom 64, I mean, because that came out on Xbox Live, didn't it? I remember that they released that on modern platforms a couple of years ago.
About 3 years ago,
Yeah, and that was, I think I actually played it a lot more on Xbox Live on my current Xbox than I ever did on the N64.
So,
the brightness control on the N64
right
has to be
thinking
too hard.
It was because of like the 3D renders and the kind of quality of it. Like, it was just a kind of raw Doom game. It was still Doom, but the way they'd enhanced it for the 64 made it kind of stand out and made it different.
Doom 64 was its own game.
It was
like separate. It's a bit of a black sheep. It was kind of separate to the other Dooms. You know, it had its own levels and a few, you know, exclusive enemies and weapons.
New art and soundtrack.
New soundtrack, and
very dark, isn't it?
It was very dark, and it was. I want to say it was environments were fully 3D as well. but it became its own entity, and it came a bit of a legendary game and a little bit of a meme because it the lighting in it is very dark, very, very, very dark game. And then it got, you know, a lot of life breathed into it when it got ported to to modern systems, you know, Xbox, etc. And it was released on like Xbox Game Pass and stuff. And they had brightened the game up as well as, you know, made it HD and everything like that. And for me, or especially a lot of my friends, my mate Stevie, who is a big Doom fan, who was never a fan of Doom 64, when they re-released it, he was like, yo, Doom 64 is actually a wicked game.
Yeah.
It was really hard to play on the N64, unfortunately. So it'd be nice to see how it comes out on the Dreamcast, because at the moment it looks nice and bright and has a decent draw distance on there.
For sure. Yeah, that makes sense that they're definitely porting it there.
I think the thing I love about Doom 64 is that it does just feel much like a scarier game. It's got a lot more of a kind of a horror vibe to it. Mm. I think the soundtrack helps with that as well. It's got a very kind of ominous soundtrack, hasn't it?
Yeah, it does, definitely.
Yes, it's very eerie. So yeah, great to see it getting ported to the Dreamcast. Like you said, it is work in progress, but with the way the Dreamcast community is these days and how helpful and, you know, everyone just really wants to see new games coming out on the system. And there's a lot of talent there as well. I've got, you know, no doubt at all that this will end up being a finished product. So if you want to get a look at it so far, and maybe you've got some experience on the Dreamcast and you can lend your talents to this project, then I'll link it up in the show notes as well. Now, I was very pleased to see, I mean, it's always cool to see games getting ported to the Amiga, but particularly so when it's one of my all-time favourites. You guys ever played the Taito legendary shoot-em-up game, Phoenix, before?
Yes, I have actually. Yeah, I've played it on emulators though. I've never played it on an Amiga. Which system did you play it on?
Arcade. Oh, I actually played it on as a kid. I remember we went to a place in Mallorca. I think it was called Calador. We went there in, would have been 1990. And that holiday, I've got bad memories of it because my mum basically put me and my brother into like a kids club that was basically worse than going to school. It was in like a basement. We went down and I'm looking up, seeing all the other kids running around the pool having fun. And like there was this this woman who looked after the kids, and she basically set us homework to do, like maths questions and all that.
Oh, man.
Terribly depressing.
That's like the worst holiday ever.
I remember saying to my mum at the end of the second day, like, oh, we want to go home. I'd rather go back to school. So luckily we didn't have to go back after that. But there was a Phoenix arcade cabinet, and there's also Kung Fu Master as well. Both of these were like near the bar area in the main hotel reception. So pretty much all of that holiday, me and my brother were just playing Kung Fu Master and Phoenix. So that is a big memory I've got, you know, just playing Phoenix nonstop on that holiday. And then actually I did manage to get it when I got back from that holiday, because I fell in love with it. I got it on the Commodore Plus 4, which was still, you know, my computer that I had at the time. Luckily it came out on the Plus 4 and actually was a really decent port. So I've always loved Phoenix. Are you familiar with it, Joe? Have you played Phoenix before?
No, I don't know it, unfortunately. When you first sent me the article, I thought it was a Beatles game and they were shooting the Yellow Submarine. From the look of one of the bosses on here.
It's not John Lennon in the spaceship at the end.
Yeah, all I can see is it's a shump kind of in the vein of like Gallagher.
Yeah, it's very early, 1980, it originally came out. It's a cool concept for a game, though, because, I mean, there's not many levels to it, from what I remember. You kind of start and you've got these kind of bat-like aliens that kind of swoop down. And then the second level of it, they hatch out of shells, and you can kind of shoot them out of the eggs, you know, as they're hatching. And then, yeah, the main level of it is you've got this alien in a spaceship, and you kind of have to, obviously there's other enemies on the screen as well, but on that last stage, you've got to shoot through the bottom of the UFO, the alien spacecraft, which is the yellow bit that you can see on that screenshot. And then there's kind of a scrolling belt in the middle, so you've got to like pierce through that as well before you can kill the main alien who's inside the spaceship. But while you're doing that, it's dropping a load of weapons on you at the same time. So it's definitely a game of, you know, fast movement and really quick reflexes to avoid kind of all of, you know, the bullets that are everywhere in it. But it was a great game. So it had like, you know, diving enemies and stuff in there as well. And like you said, for 1980, I mean, we're not talking, you know, only a couple of years after Space Invaders came out. And there were some great home ports back in the day, like I said, very good on the Plus 4, but it never came out on the Amiga. Which I think is probably just it was a bit too early to come out on 16-bit platforms. But now there is, and the reason we're talking about this is there is quite an impressive-looking homebrew port of Phoenix coming to the Amiga. And this is by, is it J-O-T-D? Is that how you pronounce his name?
Jotted.
Yeah, never know how to say his name, but he's done a lot of really good Amiga ports over the last couple of years. You know, Donkey Kong, he did Tetris as well, Moon Patrol. So he's done some really good ports to the Amiga over the last couple of years. And now
I've seen his name absolutely everywhere when it comes to arcade ports. Yeah, and I think also it's really interesting because something like this is something that should have been released back in the days, but filling the gaps nowadays is actually really like admirable task, because you know, some people would say, what's the point? You can get it on MAME, you can do this, but doing a really nice conversion of it for the Amiga, you know, a lot of people really appreciate that.
Yeah, and I think to me, I've bought this because it is available on itch.io. I'll link up his page on there, where it's one of these, you know, you name your own price. Downloaded that there's like an ADF if you want to play it off floppy disk, or there's an HD installer as well, so you can run it from your SD card or whatever you've got inside your Amiga. I haven't played it yet, I only bought it today, but I'm looking forward to having a blast on it this weekend. It looks arcade perfect from the screenshots and the video that I've seen.
You know, he's done reverse engineering on it as well, which is just amazing. Yeah, great effort.
Yeah, and it runs on all Amigas by the looks of it. You know, it's not like A1200 only. It should work on a standard Amiga 500. So if you want a really good arcade shooter for your Amiga, that is available now. Like I said, name your own price. So I'll link that up. And of course, all the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around. I'll save you the job. I put them in the show notes on your podcast app, or head to our website, click through from theretrohour.com. Now, with it being the final weekend of the month, that does mean Sunday night is hangout time again. our second one this month, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, we had to. We did delay last month by a week or so because of I went away on holiday. But yeah, it's come around pretty quick. Is it going to be the 28th? Is it Sunday 28th?
Night? Sunday 28th. Yeah. That's right. 8 p.m. UK time. Hopefully our patrons are not sick of us after hanging out a couple of weeks ago. So people turn up. But if you haven't joined us for a patrons hangout before, I mean, we talk about all sorts. I think last time we spent about an hour talking about board games.
We did, which was off the back of our last After Hours, funny enough, where we spoke about games which weren't video games, which obviously we ended up talking about board games. And we were a bit like, oh, you know, will that resonate with people? Will people enjoy that? And yeah, we ended up like half of the hangout talking about board games, and everybody saying, you know, some people hadn't heard of what we were talking about and looked it up, and then other people telling us about board games and, funny enough, video game based board games.
VHS ones, like VHS ones. It was a really interesting chat, actually.
It was really good. And, you know, we always just kind of treat it a little bit like, it's funny because I was actually telling somebody about work at it today, and I was saying how it kind of started as a bit of a COVID thing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we'll go on Google Hangout and we'll meet up, like a big Teams meeting. And it was a way of staying connected and, you know, genuinely make friends off the back of it. And here we are 4 years later. COVID's a big thing of the past now, and we still do it, you know, the last Sunday of every month. And we talk to all these brilliant people who come on, you know, from all over the world, you know, Sweden, America, you know, New Zealand, Australia, and obviously, you know, people just round the corner from us and stuff. But it's absolutely fantastic. And yeah, you know, people can come on and they can just watch, they can just listen, or they can join in. You know, I absolutely love it, and I really look forward to it every month.
And we're a very welcoming community. You know, we get new people on all the time. So if you've ever heard us talking about these hangouts, like this is basically a massive Zoom call. We all get together, you know, show off our pickups, talk about anything you like, just a bit of fun on a Sunday night. We normally do it last Sunday of the month. That does mean this weekend, we're going to be doing it 8 p.m. UK time on Sunday evening. So if you'd like to get an invite to that, all our patrons are welcome. Join right now at theretrohour.com. You did touch on there, Joe, that we do another podcast for the patrons as well called The After Hours. And actually, we're going to be recording the latest episode right after this. What's the theme this time? We're going to be talking about movies, aren't we?
We're going to be talking about retro tech movies. So we were going to do video game movies.
Yeah.
But, you know, might be a bit of a struggle to talk about our favorite video game movies. So we kind of shifted it more to the, you know, the likeness of films which are based around technology. Which obviously does involve a little bit of retro, a little bit of sci-fi.
Oh, I'm going to get geeky on this one, guys.
I'm sure you will. So we're kind of touching the waters. We're not necessarily always talking about video games. We did it with board games last month. Doing it with films this month. People seem to enjoy the board games. We'll see how this one goes.
Yeah, and if you do join us on Patreon as a gold member above, you unlock, I think it's 43 episodes?
Yeah.
Maybe 44? Of the after hours? Yeah, you've got 4 years worth of episodes, pretty much you unlock them all. So plenty of listening there. So if you'd like to join us on Patreon, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Now we're going to be continuing our Amstrad CPC 40th anniversary celebrations with our special guest. Part two of our chat with Roland Perry is on the way in just a moment. Before we do that, this sound is music to our ears. That is a sound of making money with our sponsor, Shopify. Now, Shopify is the service that is revolutionising millions of businesses all around the world. Because you know what it feels like? Everyone's either got a bit of a side hustle going on right now or maybe becoming their own boss as well. And Shopify is an all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Now, whatever you're selling, it could be online, could be in person. And I actually rather you're going to be using Shopify at your Kickstarter event, aren't you?
Yeah, because I need those little point-of-sale units. And, you know, that... they're really good because they hook up with the whole e-commerce platform. It's like all in one. And it also works on social media as well because I know places, but I don't know stuff like TikTok. Yeah. I'm not cool enough for that. But also, you know, they've got 24/7 support. And that's really important as well because if something goes down and, you know, you're losing customers, it's really important to have that instant support.
Well, I remember you saying last year at your event, you didn't have a card reader. It's cash only. You were accepted. You lost like about £1,000 worth of sales.
Oh, yeah. And the cash machine is really far away to walk to as well. So, yeah, it's really, really important to have something like Shopify.
Yeah, and I often see them at, you know, lots of retro gaming events that we go to. Even, you know, we have like a Christmas market here in the village. I saw people using them there. You know, these little shop-ready point-of-sale systems if you're selling in person. Also the e-commerce platform online as well, connected to all your social media accounts, full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth. So if you're selling anything, it is time to get serious about it today. And Shopify is a service that's got you covered and will give you the confidence and control to take your business to the next level. So if you sell anything at all, we would love you to give Shopify a try today. And of course, we always get you the best offers. Why don't you try it out for just £1 a month? £1 a month, a trial period of Shopify. Now use our link so they know that we sent you and claim that incredible offer. Head to shopify.co.uk/retrohour. All one word, all lowercase, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. I'll put that in the show notes as well. And get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. Right then, Patrons Hangout coming up on Sunday. Hopefully we'll see you there for that. And next, we continue our Amstrad CPC 40th birthday celebrations. Part two of the amazing chat with Roland Perry is next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast as we continue our celebrations of 40 years of the Amstrad CPC with our special guest, Roland Perry. Now, last week, we heard about the initial concepts and design of the system, how they went about marketing it, and of course, kickstarting the software scene as well. And this time, plenty more to cover, including the Sinclair takeover, expanding the range of CPC machines, and much more as well. But first, let's dive back in to where the machine was popular. Now, last week, we finished with Roland telling us about the CPC's popularity in Spain. So was it a conscious decision to push it more in Europe rather than America?
Well, we've always had some distribution, or Amstrad always had some distribution in Europe, but not very much. They had a long relationship with Schneider in Germany, who sold some of their audio products. But that was about it, really. Amstrad started up Amstrad France round about the time that the CPC was available in the shops. So they sold quite a few through Amstrad France. So we had Indiscomp in Spain, who started off as a software writer but became the distributor for the hardware as well. There wasn't a distributor in the USA for several years because the USA is a very strange market and has been the graveyard of so many UK tech companies that want to expand into the USA. Because in the UK, you've got it's a small country, you've got a handful of big cities. You've got London and Bristol and Birmingham and Manchester and Glasgow and Edinburgh and Leeds. And basically, if you open a shop in all of those, then, you know, you've got half the market. Unfortunately, there's about, well, there's 50 states in the USA, and each of those states has got about three big cities in it. So you're talking about, you know, a couple of hundred stores that you have to open in the USA to get that coverage. And that's just completely impossible. I mean, the amount of money that costs is ridiculous. Mm. So nobody's ever been able to do it. The way you do it, and what Amstrad did years later, but only for the 6128s and then later the PCs, was to get their products into Sears, which is a big department store chain in the United States. And they do have shops in the high streets of, you know, those several hundred major UK cities, US cities. So that's the only way you can do it. But to penetrate, you know, to get onto the Sears list into their shops is a really, really difficult thing to do. But we did manage eventually.
I'm quite interested to hear a bit about Lord Sugar's influence on the system, because I know even watching, you know, programs like The Apprentice today, he occasionally does tasks that involve, you know, like the Amstrad CPC. It might be, you know, he sends the candidates out to find one somewhere. And I've often seen him on Twitter, you know, sharing images from back in the 80s of the computer. So it seems like he's very fond of it today. I mean, how did his leadership influence the development and the success of the CPC systems, do you think? I mean, was he actually interested in computers outside of it just being a product?
Well, his role was basically being a visionary and a financier. So he says, I want to do this and I've got the money and we're just bloody well going to do it. And everyone says, yes, sir, of course, sir. So off they all go and do it. I don't think that he was particularly attached to games computers as such. When we started, it was just another product. But I know that when we got to the PCW, it was, we'd actually kind of turned the corner a bit there, and he was rather fond of that. And of course, we called it Joyce after his secretary. And he used to type his own letters on his PCW rather than dictate them to Joyce and things like that. So I think we kind of converted him into a computer geek eventually.
Well, talking about the, you know, obviously those systems when the PCW came along, and also the later CPC systems as well, when you kind of moved away from cassette tape as the main storage method, obviously the floppy disk became quite important in the mid to late 80s. And it was quite interesting to see that Amstrad chose the 3-inch floppy disk format, which, you know, from memory, I can only remember Amstrad really ever using that here in the UK. Why was the 3-inch floppy disk chosen as the main storage method then, rather than the traditional 5.25 or 3.5-inch discs?
Well, this is kind of one of my pet peeves, really, because the 3.5-inch disc was not commonplace then. It was several years before IBM decided it was going to adopt that as its format, and before then it was out in the wilderness. People forget that. So it wasn't any more famous back in 1983 than the 3-inch format was. So also, a 3.5-inch drive cost more than the whole CPC put together. So it's just completely that a non-starter. 5.25-inch, again, physically far too big, about five times too expensive to be able to put in a consumer product like a CPC or a PCW. So you have to go out and say, well, this is one of my jobs was to say, okay, so we've ruled out the 3.5-inch because it doesn't exist. We've ruled out the 5.25 because it's too big and too expensive. What are we going to use instead? So you go out and you talk to the manufacturers, and one of them turned up and said, oh, look, I've got this 2-inch floppy. And he said, really? They said, yeah, look, it's like a 5.25-inch floppy, but it's shrunk down to 2 inches. And you go, that's terribly interesting. Well, how much data does it store? And if we ordered 100,000 of them next week. When could you deliver them? And how much would they cost? And all the rest of it. So you could talk to them. You then go and talk to people who made things which were a bit like Sinclair micro drives, which are, again, notoriously unreliable. And I don't think we would ever have used them simply because of the reliability issues. And you say to them, well, okay, well, how much days does it store? How long does it take to load some software? And if we ordered, place an order for 100,000 tomorrow, when could deliver them, all the rest of it, at which point they all sort of make their excuses and leave, basically. And one of the, which haven't left us with this 3-inch floppy, which Panasonic, as it's now known, that's its latest sort of marketing name. It's actually Matsushita in Japan. And they had this 3-inch floppy, which they'd designed and hadn't found many takers for. But, you know, we talked to them and said, well, okay, tell us about this. How does it work? You know, what are the good features? What are the bad features? Actually, the original USP of the drive was the hard shell on the floppy. And the idea was that if you wanted to mail somebody a floppy disk, you could literally just write their address on the label and stick a stamp on it and chuck it in the mailbox.
Right.
It was robust enough to do that. Well, that kind of idea they had never really caught on. I mean, literally in 40 years, I've never seen a three-inch disk drive with a postage stamp on it.
No.
But apparently that's what they're going to tell you. So we looked at it and we said to them, well, okay, this seems to work. It's also plug compatible with a 5 1/4-inch drive, which a 3.5-inch wasn't. Okay, 3.5-inch was a proprietary connector on it. And so you needed new disk controllers, new software. It was all kind of complete can of worms. But the 3-inch drive, it was plug compatible with a 5 1/4-inch drive. So you could literally take a 5 1/4-inch drive out of an IBM PC, which were quite new at the time, plug a 3-inch drive in, and you could read and write to it using the standard early dots on an IBM machine, which is quite useful for software developers to do. And, of course, vice versa. Once we designed the CPC's disk drive controllers and software, if you wanted to, you had to just sort of hang out the side, but you could plug a 5 1/4-inch drive into a CPC and it would read and write that with, you know, absolutely no fiddling about or anything.
Well, I was wondering how Amstrad changed then when the Sinclair acquisition happened. And, you know, that was absolutely huge news. I wondered what your memories were at that time.
Well, my main memory was, because for reasons we haven't got time to talk about today, I ended up being the building manager at Bromwood in the iconic office block there. It was my fault Amstrad moved to Brentwood, because when I got offered a position with Amstrad after having, you know, they poached me off of Ambit, I said, well, I'll come and work for you, but I'm not going to drive all the way to Tottenham and back every day. That'd be completely, utterly crazy. So you've got to find me an office in Brentwood. So they said, all right, we'll find you an office in Brentwood. And then they, quite soon afterwards, they said, okay, we'll find you a whole tower block in Brentwood. So I ended up being the building manager for a bit. So because I didn't persuade Amstrad PLC to move to Brentwood, I said, I'm not going to move to Tottenham. So I'm going to work in Brentwood. So we're going to sort of find something that works for both of us here. And so I found that building and effectively said, well, I want to rent one floor of this. And Amstrad said, okay, well, we're actually going to buy the whole thing. But it's all your fault, so you can be the building manager for the next couple of months while you get refurbish it before we move in. And so I was really quite friendly with the all the security staff and people like that, the guy on the front desk. One day I was just flipping through the visitor's book, which is on the counter in reception, and I thought, and there was this Clive Sinclair to see Alan Shipper. I was going, wonder what's going on there. The problem was that basically, Sinclair was broke. the business the previous Christmas, their business had completely dried up. And so they bought lots of components, made lots of computers, put them in the shops. Nobody had bought them. And by about the end of February, all their creditors were getting a bit impatient and saying, when are you going to pay us for these? And Sinclair was going, well, we haven't got any money, so what's going to happen? And they went round looking for a white knight to rescue them. And they had a, you probably read, they had a deal almost done with Robert Maxwell.
Yeah.
With Mirasoft.
Yeah, but that fell through. And so he kind of doing the rounds, eventually ended up with Amstrad, and obviously must have come to this meeting, talked to Lord Sugar, and Lord Sugar said, well, you know, I'll give you $5 million for basically the brand name. And he said, okay, I'll take the money. So he did. All we wanted was the brand name. We didn't want his warehouse full of broken ZX81s or his warehouse full of not yet working QLs and all the rest of it. We just wanted the brand name because we knew that if we re-engineered his product, keeping it completely software compatible and everything, of course, that we could sell enough of them to get back the investment in the brand name. And that's all it was. It wasn't anything much more complicated than that.
That's interesting to hear, because I did wonder about that, you know, when the acquisition happened, whether you kind of looked at the range of machines they already had and kind of decided what you were going to do with each one. Because, I mean, you know, you've mentioned the QL a few times, which was famously, you know, Sinclair's failed attempt to enter the business market. I mean, I guess you didn't have very high opinions of that machine, and I guess Amstrad had no plans to ever continue manufacturing QLs.
Well, no, but in fact, I've alluded to this before, because I said earlier, I think, that the QL was cost cut to the point at which it didn't work anymore. And in fact, on that week that I went round trawling my friends, one of the friends I went to was one of the senior engineers working for Sinclair trying to make the QL into a marketable product. And, you know, he was at his wit's end because he knew it was never going to work. But on the other hand, he didn't want to give up his reasonably steady job at that point to come and work for me. So, you know, it's all a very small community. I think people underestimate how small and friendly, in fact, the community was. I mean, we were not in competition with the BBC Micro. You know, we were not trying to get on national TV as their chosen computer. We weren't trying to get into schools particularly. We had a computer that was half the price of the BBC Micro and better engineered, not because they were bad engineers, but because we had at least 2 years. You know, it was 2 years later. And things get better 2 years later just because you've learnt more about things. So, no, I think the whole thing's, you know, all the people in Amstrad and Sinclair and Acorn literally used to just go to the pub together, you know, and talk about what they were doing, not commercial things like what you were going to be launching and how much it cost to build and how much you're going to sell it for and all the rest of it, but just generally just being friends and saying, oh, we've heard about this new, you know, this new thing that's going on, you know, are you going to get involved in that or not? And we've heard about CPM. What do you think about CPM or this, that or the other?
I'm quite interested to hear about the Spectrum and the CPC range kind of coexisting in the same company, because obviously when you got hold of the Spectrum, you know, you've got your hands on one of your major competitors there. So how did you go about kind of rearranging and positioning the Spectrum and CPC range under the same company? I mean, was a bit of rivalry between the teams and brands, and how did you make them coexist?
Well, we actually hired one ex-Sinclair employee who ended up working on my engineering team. So it was only just the one of them, and they were probably more interested in the CPC anyway at that stage. So it's just merely a case of using the production engineering skills to take the Spectrum design and manufacture it in a lower cost, more reliable fashion. And it's no more complicated than that.
Well, let's go back to the CPC then, because obviously that was still a really important product for Amstrad, and it was still being developed as well. When we got to the CPC 664, how did you improve on the 464 system specs, and what were the aims of upgrading the system?
Well, that was really straightforward. We had the 464, which had the cassette drive in it. We had the DDNL01, which is an external 3-inch floppy disk drive. So you could buy the combination. And in fact, this goes back to this thing about why did we choose the 3-inch disk drive? Well, we actually had prototypes of the DDI1 at the product launch in Westminster 40 years ago. So we didn't select the 3-inch disk drive when we were thinking about doing the 664 or the 6128. It had been at least a year before that. And we just got bombarded by people saying, oh, for heaven's sake, you know, why can't you just build a 464 with a disk drive in it rather than a tape drive? Hmm. Because it's just cosmetics, you know, it's just kind of changing the plastic moulding. There's no difference in the software at all. There's no difference in the electronics. It's just taking those two components and sticking them inside one bit of plastic. And we did that. But for other reasons, which I'm sure we'll go on to discuss, everyone then criticised us for doing what they'd been screaming at us to do for months.
That must have been quite frustrating, was it, when you got that reaction?
Well, it was a bit because, you know, if your customers are saying, why don't you stick them together in the same box and, of course, make it cheaper than buying the two boxes separately, and then do it, and then everyone says, well, that's a load of rubbish, isn't it? Then you think, well, why didn't we bother, really?
Well, talking about the higher-end models, so we had the CPC 6128, and that included CPM support as well, which I thought was quite interesting, because obviously before, I mean, you know, it did kind of feel like aiming much more at that kind of home market. And we mentioned, you know, that Amstrad initially kind of wanted it to be a bit more like a game system. But obviously CPM was used in business. So was that seen as important to attract the non-gaming audience? And why was that decision made then to go down that route?
Well, it was entirely my fault and quite selfish, really, because we did the 6128, which incidentally was launched earlier in the USA, because they said they couldn't launch the 464 or the 664 because it only had 64K memory. They refused to launch something unless it had 128K memory in it. So we had to rush the 6128 a little bit and market it first in the USA. The reason for the CPM is because myself and my department were responsible for first-line support to software houses and people like that, as well as to certainly set the general public. And I'd been using CPM for about 10 years by then in my former hats on, and I could see that it was an obvious use for the extra 64K of memory to be able to support CPM. But what I didn't want to do was have half a dozen different companies all trying to port CPM onto the 6128, ringing me up all day long saying, how do I do this? You know, I've got stuck, help me out, and blah, blah, blah. So I said, I'll just get Locomotive to do this, and we'll just bundle it. You know, that's just going to save us so much time and anguish in the long run. So it wasn't, in a sense, really even because I was expecting a lot of people to use the CPM, although actually it turns out they did. It was just to put everything I could into that product from day one without CPM being a kind of a bodged aftermarket product from half a dozen different third parties.
Well, were there any projects or prototypes related to the CPC that, you know, never saw the light of day?
Well, one of the things that I liked about Amstrad was that almost every project you started ended up in the shops, whereas some of my friends who worked for Acorn were very frustrated that only about 1 in 10 of the projects they started ever ended up in the shops. So the only product that we started which didn't reach the market was something called the Ant. And we always gave these machines code names, and it's Arnold number 2. And the Ant, which actually we got working in prototype form, and there was nothing wrong with it technically. It was basically a colour PCW.
Right.
So it could have played games, and it had like a kind of software switch inside it. So you could say, okay, now you're a PCW word processor, do word processing, switch the switch over. Okay, now you're a color CPC, but you're using the hardware of the PCW. So you're using the screen and the disk drives and things on the PCW. It didn't have much else. I mean, it had a bigger bitmap on the screen because the PCW had a bigger bitmap than the CPC, and it has 64 colours rather than 27. Apart from that, it was pretty much the same product. However, we were so busy at the time. We were right in the middle of designing the PC clones, the PC-1512 and whatever. Also designing a PCW with a daisy wheel printer in it and so on and so forth. And we just simply didn't have the hours in the day to bring all these products to market. And the one which got the chop was the Ant.
So, I mean, obviously the PCW range, I mean, that was really targeted to be a word processor, really. I remember, you know, they're really popular. I remember, you know, several of my family members bought those machines just to do word processing at home. So it would have seemed interesting that you had, you know, the CPC that was really the colour games machine, that kind of overlap, you know. I guess there were probably different markets there, weren't they, the PCW range and the CPC?
Well, that was something which worried a few people. They said, well, yeah, look, the PCW is a business computer, even if it's only sole traders and, you know, very small businesses, and the CPC is obviously a games machine. How can you possibly market a computer that's both of them at the same time? And maybe there's some truth in that. But anyway, so that's the only project we ever started that never got finished.
Well, you left Amstrad in 1990. I mean, before we get into that, I mean, Amstrad obviously did continue the CPC range. I mean, we had the Plus range of machines that came along, and also the GX4000 console as well. I mean, before you left Amstrad, were these in development, and did you have much to do with those systems?
Well, I had almost nothing to do with those because I was fully occupied doing the PC clones by that stage. And so I had members of staff who were dealing with the various variants of CPC pluses and Spectrum pluses and all this kind of nonsense. I was fully occupied getting the PC clones going and implementing early versions of Windows and things like that. It's just kind of addressing quite a different market, actually quite a lot of work. Well, I ended up being the biggest customer for Windows outside the USA at the time. You know, they were selling more copies of Windows to Amstrad than anybody else in the world. Outside the USA. And so people keep asking me particularly about the console and things like that, but I just really didn't have nothing to do with them.
That was quite an interesting idea to consolize the CPC, though, because I guess that was obviously quite an emerging market in the UK at the time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it was probably a bit too late to market, and being, you know, it had the kind of the 8-bit jinx on it. So, but again, you know, that's none of my concern. I just wasn't involved in that. You know, I'd moved on to other products in the range.
Well, why did you leave Amstrad in 1990?
Well, this is a really interesting question. There's all kinds of answers. I suppose the main one was that by 1990 or by 1989, I used to live in Brentwood, about 200 yards from the office, and I was single and used to work about kind of 80 hours a week on Amstrad business. and used to go into the office at weekends, which we weren't really supposed to do. But of course, being part-time building manager, I had the keys, so I could do it anyway. and then I got married and we moved to Oxfordshire. And so Amstrad became then a 9-to-5 job with a, you know, 1.5-hour commute either way. It all got a bit wearing, really. So I thought, well, actually, maybe I'll just chuck that bit in and concentrate on running my own business here in Oxfordshire.
Well, as we celebrate, you know, 40 years of the Amstrad CPC, what would you like its legacy to be remembered for?
I think as being a computer which introduced so many people to the idea that they could perhaps not just play games, but also become a sort of a novice programmer and learn about computers. One of the things that they do in Spain is, I think it's at possibly Barcelona University, the professor who runs their computer science course, whose first computer was a CPC, and I met him last summer. He has a compulsory module on his course, which is you have to write a game for the CPC. There's lots of second-hand CPCs in Spain because it's a very popular computer, so they can all get their own little computer to borrow to do that. And it also teaches the students that actually, rather than writing everything in sort of high-level languages, that it is possible and sometimes necessary to write software in assembler code. And you might as well write it for the Z80. It doesn't matter if the game they write isn't terribly good, but at least they need to be able to kind of, you know, string one together. So it's I think it was this goes back to my original theme, which is that I regarded it just as much as a tool for people to learn about computers as to be just a console with a big keyboard on it. And I just spend so much time meeting people who come up to me or email me or talk to me on Facebook and things who say, I'm so grateful that this computer existed because that's how I got a start in my career.
Yeah, and I imagine these people are now that are, you know, could be working in the industry full time, managers of companies, you know, all got their start on that system. That must be pretty heartwarming to hear those stories from people.
Yeah, I mean, they're all now about kind of 50 years old and got some spare time and some spare pocket money, and they're going back and buying up old CPCs that people just found in their attic. So yeah, it's next year's antiques, I think.
Well, I mean, talking about the kind of the current CPC scene, do you get invited to events then? Do you kind of keep up to date with, you know, these homebrew developments? Do you kind of see much of this?
Well, I'm getting more involved in it because so it's really only blossomed in the last couple of years, but I do get a reasonable number of invites to go to retro computer shows and things like that, which I'm very happy to do. I think, yeah, I think it's great. You know, people are very enthusiastic about the computer because part of anything else, they can do several things. Not only can they relive their youth, but there's actually work to be done because these computers, I mean, literally most of them are like 35, 40 years old, the computers, and so they need restoring. Yeah, the cleaning, restoring, and all the rest of it. So that's more work people can put into it. And then there's lots of new games being written for them, which are much more certainly visually exciting than the original games. And so it just breeds a whole kind of culture of CPCism. Unfortunately, not very much in the UK. Which is something I'm trying to stir up at the moment a bit. It's not so much in the UK, but it's definitely in Spain, a little bit in France, and possibly a little bit in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that these machines are even, you know, still running 40 years later. I imagine when you designed them, you expected them to last maybe like 2 or 3 years at most, never mind like 4 decades. So I think that's testament.
It's much worse than that. If you come to us when we put in that bid originally, which was to design a computer that they were going to sell 100,000 or 200,000 for Christmas 84 and say, actually, we're going to sell 5 or 6 million of those over the next 4 or 5 years, we'd have just said, I'm sorry, that's, you know, beyond our comprehension, and we can't, we can't do that. That's too much of a risk if we failed. So no, we didn't expect it to be other than a, I'll say a 1 year wonder, but certainly not something that was going to go on and on and on the way it did. Because I say that would have been just too daunting to be, have the responsibility to deliver that.
And having these people still keeping these machines alive as well, which is just amazing.
Well, yeah, well, there's various people who, not quite a profession, but the several people who specialise in restoring old CPCs, just like there's people who specialise in restoring old E-type Jaguars.
Yeah, definitely a good comparison. So 40 years on from the launch of the Amstrad CPC, what are you doing these days, Roland? What's your life like today?
Well, I don't know. I mean, now I've, in theory, I've fully retired, so I'm a bit of a crossroads at the moment. So I don't know what I'm going to do next, but I've had so many different careers, and that's something which, again, people find difficult, because I know, and it's not their fault, it's not society's fault, it's just the way things are. They do the same or roughly the same job for 40 years and then they retire.
Yeah.
Well, I've done probably about 6 completely different careers in my 50 years, and the CPC was just one of those that lasted for just 6 years. And while it's, in a sense, delightful that people keep concentrating on that 6 years in my life, there's another, you know, 44 years in my career where I was being just as manic and just as productive in completely different industries. And, you know, some of that I'm just as proud of as what I did at Amstrad.
Sounds like you might have a book in you, Roland. Might be a book's worth of material there.
Yeah, don't you start. No, we're going to we're gonna have to write a... Well, I need a ghostwriter, actually. So I'm trying to I'm casting around for a ghostwriter to interview me for about 6 months and write it all down and produce a book. But it's going to be very diverse. And I'm not quite sure what's wrong with that. But, I mean, lots of people just stay in the same line of work for a very long time, so they've got less to talk about. And the fact that I've got itchy feet and moved around so much means that, you know, I've just seen so much more of the world and so much more of, particularly, I mean, just generally speaking, my career moved from consumer electronics to online to legal affairs. So, yeah, each of those is, has got a story to tell.
Well, yeah, I hope you make that happen, Roland. That'd be an incredible read. And we've really appreciated you taking some time to talk to us as well. It's been amazing hearing your memories of, like you said, it was only 6 years, but, you know, it's obviously a really important part of home micro history here in Britain and you know, across Europe as well. So thank you so much for coming on and celebrating 40 years of the Amstrad CPC with us, Roland. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Well, you're very welcome.